the studies that we're using in our small groups. And I thought it was a great illustration of the basic issue of Esther. Who is in charge? This is the fundamental question that the serpent posed to Eve and to every person since Eden. This question is in the forefront of our minds even when we are young. When one of my grandsons was 3 years old, his mother left him in my care at my home. As she was driving away, he put his hands on his hips, pulled back his shoulders, looked at me, and asked with an authoritative tone, "Well, who's in charge here?" After I got over the shock, I got down to his level, looked him in the eye, and replied, "You are not." He literally shook with surprise. Then we had a lovely conversation with him sitting on my lap as I explained that he was our guest and we were responsible for his care when he was with us. He was satisfied, and we had a wonderful time together. If you have little children that you care for, sometimes you know that that issue of who is in charge here is an issue that we all struggle with. And that's the entire story of Esther chapter 1 that we're going to be taking a look at this morning. In fact, that's the story of the entire book of Esther. In just a couple of paragraphs, we see exactly what is going on. Esther 1 is all about who's in charge. In theological terms, here's the question. Who has the right to rule? Who has the right to rule? What we discover is, in this book as a whole, that we think that we're in charge when, in fact, ultimately God is the one who is in charge. And that question and that struggle is true for Xerxes, the king that we're going to read about. It's true for his wife, Vashti, the queen that we're going to read about in chapter 1. It's true for Haman. It's true for Mordecai. It's true for Esther. It's true for all of the people that we are going to read about in these 10 chapters of the book of Esther. But it's also true for you and I. Who is in charge of our life? Now, I'm going to phrase this first chapter this way. Xerxes, the king that we're going to read about, is a really good, bad example. Look at the things that he does and don't do that. Because he's a good, bad example. He makes a lot, and I'm going to use a theological term here, he makes a lot of boneheaded decisions. Xerxes doesn't get it. He hasn't figured out yet who is in charge. He thinks he is. Read with me Esther chapter 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. So from India all the way over to what we would call now the Nile, to Egypt. I mean, he was in charge of almost the entire then known world. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. He had three major capitals. This is one of the three. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. Xerxes had a party. 6 month long party. That's a lot of party. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace, the hanging gardens of Babylon, some would say. In the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the city of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wanted. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from the wine. Now, this is going to give you a clue about where we're going to end up, right? What's going on? On the seventh day, after 6 months, drinking all the wine that they want, he is in high spirits from the wine. He's about to get himself in a world of hurt. He commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abigatha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown. Some commentators would say wearing only her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. And then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of the law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. Carshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Now, this is pretty smart, right? Let's ask seven men who are in charge of the then known world through this provincial rule, who have been drinking wine for 6 months, what they think you should do. I'm sure that that's going to get you a smart answer. Don't you think, Alan? Yeah, that's going to get you a good answer. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the law of the Persians and the Medes, which cannot be repealed. In this day and age, in this kingdom, when the king made a law, he couldn't even go back and change it himself. That's how absolute his rule was. That Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. If that's all it takes, right? Is just saying that it has to be done. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. Well, they've been drinking wine for 6 months. It made sense. So the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in his own script, and to each people in his own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be the ruler of his own household. And that settles that, right? Some of your ladies are just shaking your head. You're like, what in the world is going on here? Esther is a marvelous story, in some instances, of what not to do. Four things, four don'ts, that we need to learn from Esther as we enter into this study for the next couple of weeks. Number one, don't forget who ultimately is in charge of everything. Don't forget who ultimately is in charge of everything. From the outside looking in, when you read this first chapter, it appears as if Xerxes is the one who is ruling, right? I mean, he is large and in charge. He's got it going on. He is in charge of 127 provinces throughout the then known world. Take a look at the map at the time of Esther, what is going on. Here's the Persian Empire. Look at he rules everything. There's one little place that he hasn't yet taken over. Up there in the upper left-hand corner where you see Greece, and Thrace and Macedonia, where that red line is, everything this direction from the red line, he has control over. That little bit of Greece up there is the only place of civilization at that point that he doesn't have control over. And many historians say this. One of the things that he is doing during this during this 6-month-long party, he's bringing all of the rulers of all of these different places together. He's planning to conquer Greece. Because about 3 years after this party is over, they have an attempted invasion of Greece. Does not go well. You've probably heard of the Battle of Thermopylae. That would be where it took place. Xerxes finally won, but it was one of those things where he lost through winning. It was not a good day for the Medes and for the Persians. He controls a kingdom that he makes laws that even he cannot reverse. Every material trapping of wealth and power is there. He's having a 6-month-long banquet that makes the Roman banquets look like a birthday party. He's got gold, silver, precious stones. He's walking on them. He's created a marble floor with inset mosaic of jewels. I mean, he has every trapping of power, and he is displaying his wealth and his splendor and his glory. And you can't mistake it. You can't miss it. When you go back and read it, in 20 of 22 verses, now look, 20 of 22 verses, the word king, queen, or royal is found. You think he's trying to make a point? King, queen, or royal is found in chapter 1, in 20 of 22 verses. He makes laws that he can't change himself. And so in his mind, he is in charge. He has answered the question of who is in charge. I am. But from the very beginning of this story, we begin to see that there's a little bit of unrest taking place. Xerxes does not have absolute control. He has the illusion of control. Because his wife, Vashti, refuses to obey his summons. The rest of the world might quake when he speaks. The rest of the world might jump when he says hop. But guess what? Vashti ain't having no part of that. She is not a prize filly on display for his drunk friends. She's not coming out for that. And Xerxes, he isn't smart enough to know what to try to control and what to leave the heck alone. He still thinks he's in charge. I saw this meme this past week. I had to put it up on the screen. It's awesome. Guys, you'll really appreciate this. One monkey says to the other, "You play any dangerous sports?" And he says, "Yeah, I sometimes disagree with my wife." That's a dangerous sport right there. That'll get you in a world of hurt. Xerxes hadn't figured that out yet. He thinks that because he's king, that he can rule everything in every way in every instance. And his counselors give him probably the worst advice in the history of mankind, and he's dumb enough to follow it. It's good to have counselors, but you need to have wise counselors. And guys who've been at a 6-month party drinking all the wine that they want are probably not going to give you good advice to make your domestic life work well. And they don't. He tries to do something that no one can do. He tries to command respect. Isn't that? He tries to command respect. I love the way I read this. And every time I read it, I laugh. It's hysterically funny. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in his own script, and to each people in his own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler of his own household. Because that's all it takes, right? That's all it takes. It's just say, hey, you know, I am the king. I'm going to deem that you are in charge. Let me know how that works out for you. When you read the rest of Esther, it's pretty clear. Didn't work out for him either. You see, Xerxes was confused about something that we are often confused about. It's this issue that has been going on since the Garden of Eden. Who is in charge? You have to settle that. In the garden, God said no The serpent said yes. Adam and Eve went, huh, yeah, we think we won't do that. God, you're not in charge. We are. Xerxes tried the same thing. The little boy in the story tried the same thing. Who is in charge? Here's what the scripture says. Proverbs 21, Xerxes didn't figure this out. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, and he directs it like a water course wherever he pleases. Because God is in charge. You know, when you have a little bit of power, when you have a little bit of influence, it doesn't matter where that power and influence is demonstrated. It can easily and quickly go to your head. Go back and read in John chapter 19 the story of Jesus standing before Pilate with his life on the line. Go back and read it. Here's what Pilate says. He looks at Jesus because Jesus isn't toeing the line. He isn't doing what Pilate wants him to do. And he says, don't you understand? He said, don't you understand? I have the power. He uses that word. He phrases it that way. I have the power to set you free or crucify you. What part of this don't you get, Jesus? Jesus looked at him and he said, you would have no power if it were not given to you from above. You see, we forget that God is in charge. And we can never forget that, because when we do, we end up right where Xerxes is. We create for ourselves a word of hurt, world of hurt, because we do what we think is right. We gather our friends together and we get tons and tons of really bad advice. And we begin to follow that path, and it ends up in all kinds of destruction. Secondly, never confuse knowledge and wisdom. Never confuse knowledge with wisdom. That's what's going on here. If you take a look at this passage of Scripture, it says, since it was customary for the king, verse 13, to consult experts in matters of the law and justice, these are experts, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. He called his friends together. Hey, guys, let's talk about it. I got a domestic issue at home. And you know what they did? They immediately turned it into a worldwide problem. Well, that's going to be helpful. That's really going to move us forward here, Xerxes. According to the law, what must be done to Vashti, he asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken. So Memucan speaks to him and says, you know what, this is going to cause all kinds of trouble. Here's what I think we should do. She didn't want to come in here. We should make sure that she never comes in here again. Well, that's kind of dumb if she didn't want to be there in the first place. Yeah. But that's what they decided they wanted to do. You see, knowledge, here's a critical difference. Knowledge is having a grip on the facts. It's one thing to have a grip on the facts, but it's an entirely different thing to know what the heck to do with them. That's the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge says this is the correct information. Wisdom says this is the correct course of action based on that information. You know some people who are really, really, really smart and they have all the facts? And day after day after day after day, they make every single wrong decision because they're just not very wise. That's what's going on here. And when you go back and you read it, the first time I read that, it clicked in my mind. I said, there's somewhere else in the Bible where that phrase is used. People who understood the times. And I had to rack my brain for it a little bit. But it goes all the way back to 1 Chronicles chapter 12 and verse 32. Because this is a place where in David's day, he was gathering together men who would come to support him as he is in this struggle with Saul. And they're back there listing in Chronicles this list of these people and these people and these people and these people. It's one of those places where you fall asleep when you're trying to read through the Bible. Because it's just over and over and over, just one of those things. It's kind of like Leviticus, that Kings and Chronicles stuff time gets pretty deadly. But right in the middle of this long, long, long list of information, it talks about the men of Issachar, now look at this, who understood the times. And if you put that side by side with the seven nobles here in the original Hebrew language, it is exactly the same Hebrew phrase. But in Chronicles, there is an addition. There's a single word that is added. In Chronicles, it says not only did they understand the times, a word for information, but they also knew what Israel should do. And you know what that is a word for? Wisdom. There's a difference. There's a difference between knowing the facts and knowing the right course of action. The men that were advising Xerxes, they had the facts right. They just reached the wrong conclusion. Did they do it because they were boneheaded? Maybe. Because their ego got in the way? Maybe. Because they've been drinking wine for 6 months? Maybe. But they reached the wrong conclusion. You see, a wise man would have said, Xerxes, Sebastian, you need to work that out. How about we just relax for the night? How about we take a deep breath and everybody go home? And we'll talk about that in the morning when the wine is worn off. But they didn't do that. They weren't that wise. See, here's the key. They didn't understand the difference between knowledge and wisdom. And so they went with what they thought was the right course of action. Proverbs says it to us this way, there is a way that seems right into a man. There's a way that seems to make sense, but the end thereof leads to, anybody know what the last word is? Death. When you fast forward through the rest of what's going on in Esther, and you see all kinds of death, all kinds of destruction, because they took really, really bad advice. Yes, it's good to get counsel. But you need to be sure you get wise counsel. Men who've been at a party for the last 6 months probably not going to give you the best ideas. Just because someone is good at running the kingdom doesn't mean he's going to be wise in dealing with his home life. You need to be very careful who you go to for advice and making sure they fully understand what's going on and that they are wise. Never confuse knowledge and wisdom. Just because they got facts does not necessarily mean that they know the right course of action. Third thing you've got to pay attention to here in this story. The third, don't. Don't be confused about what makes up true success. Don't be confused about what makes up true success. This is an area that we get in so much trouble because we live like Xerxes. We define success incorrectly. When you get to the end of chapter 1, it appears that Xerxes has been successful. I mean, what's not to like? He's pulled off the party of the century. Maybe one of the biggest parties of all times. He has impressed everyone who has seen it. He's probably planned the next big war. He's going to use this as a launch pad to grab the last little piece of the world that he doesn't yet own. He's pulled all the leaders of his incredible empire and kingdom together, and they have an agreement on what to do. He has put Vashti in her place and solved that problem. He has issued a decree that will ensure that every man will be respected in his home, and he has issued a decree that will ensure that every man is the ruler in his own home. Because that's all it takes, right? It's just a rule. He has been successful. If you use his definition of success. But I would submit to you that success is not how much you have, whether it is money or power or influence or things or friends. Success is not when everybody applauds because you have done, in their idea, a good job. I tell young pastors this all the time. Because they get some criticism or they get some praise. And I say to them this, you are not as good as your fans tell you you are. And you are not as bad as your enemies tell you you are. You just hold on to that. That's not success. Success isn't when everybody stands and applauds. Success isn't when your 401 is fully funded. Success isn't when you have everything that you desire. Success isn't when you can throw a party and invite all your friends and they all come and everybody has everything that they want. Because you see, the bumper sticker is wrong. I still see it every once in a while. It says, the one who dies with the most toys wins. Seen that one lately? Not as popular as it was a few years ago. It's coming back, don't worry. It does all about every 10 years. It shows back up. Because we define success many times as how much we have, whether it is money, power, influence, friends, people. We define success that way. That's not success. It's foolish sometimes. Go back and ask the rich man who had so much success, the Bible says, that his barns wouldn't hold everything. He had to go out and get a different money manager. Because his money manager didn't deal with numbers that big anymore. He had to go somewhere else. And in his mind, he is successful. And the Bible says to him this, God looked at him and said, "You fool." Now, if I think you're foolish and I call you a fool, that's one thing. Take that with a grain of salt. When God looks at you and calls you a fool, guess what? You're a fool. I'm just saying, it's true. When God looks at you and says you fool, you might want to listen to what He has to say. Andy Stanley has the best definition of true success that I think I've ever seen. True success is when those that are closest to you and know you the best love and respect you the most. Husbands, think about that. How does your wife and your children look at you? I don't want to care what your boss has to say. I don't care. He might have been drinking wine for the last 6 months. I don't care what your friends say. That's not success. I don't care what your sports team says. I don't care what your fantasy league says. I don't care any of those things. Here's what I want to know. What I want to know is, what does your wife say? What do your children say? Do they love and respect you the most? Because if they don't, then you are not successful. I don't care what you have, where you go, how many people clap you on the back and tell you you're a good man. When your wife and your children do not love and respect you, and for Xerxes, he's got a problem. I mean, I want to hit that pause button here for just a second. Ladies, you forgive me because I want to talk to the men, okay? Because while this is a problem for women as well, it is not nearly the problem that it is for men. For men, we allow everything else in our life to be important to us. We will sacrifice the love and respect of our wives and of our children so that our friends like us better and are happy with what we do. There's a theological term for that. It's called stupid. I'm just telling you, okay? We allow our egos to get in the way. We allow our jobs to get in the way. We allow our hobbies and our sports and our friends to become the most important thing in our life, while our most important relationships, our marriages and our children, suffer. And when we do that, we fall in the footsteps of Xerxes. You follow him long enough and you're going to end up where he ended up. We have to put a map on the board so that people know how big his empire was today. Nobody even knows. Nobody even cares. They don't talk about how big his empire was. They talk about how stupid he was when he tried to get Vashti to do something she shouldn't have been doing in the first place. Be foolish. Don't be confused about what makes up true success. Then there's one more place that I want to spend just a moment before we finish this morning. Never assume. Don't assume, because you can't see God's hand, that He is absent in what is going on. If you've already started your study of Esther in some of the Bible studies or some of the small groups, you'll know this. The name of God is never seen in Esther in any way, form, or fashion. It's not there. He's never mentioned. Prayer is never mentioned in Esther. Fasting is mentioned, but not prayer is never mentioned. It's simply not there. He is never called on. He is never referenced. He is never attributed to, from what we can see throughout the entire book. He's never even thought about. But He is everywhere in the book of Esther. And we fall into this pattern of Xerxes. We think that because God isn't right there in our face, that He's not paying attention to what's going on. We think we're in charge. But Matthew Henry, this old commentator, he's been around for a while. I had to actually go back and look it up. I knew who he was, but I didn't know. I didn't remember how. Matthew Henry has been a commentator. His commentary has been published 300 years. Most pastors I know still reference him because he's so stinking smart. Here's what he says about Esther. He says, "But though the name of God be not in it," a little bit archaic language, "the finger of God is, directing many minute events for the bringing about of His people's deliverance." He is present with them in their exile in a foreign land because that's why they're there in the first place. They have been disobedient. They're taken away into captivity. That's why they're there. He's present with them in every single moment of danger throughout the entire book. He's present with them in dozens of happenstance circumstances that one after the other fall in their favor. It just so happens over and over and over again that it turns their way. He is present when they can't imagine why He would allow something so awful as a law to be made that says that the Jewish people are fair game throughout that 127 provinces, and they can be hunted down and killed at will and their property taken by those who kill them. And that became a law of the Medes and the Persians which could not be changed. And we look at that and we go, "God, where are You?" Have you done that? You've been in that place in your life where you look at Him and you go, "God, where are You? I don't see You anywhere. I don't understand how You could have allowed such an awful thing to take place." But listen, He is always there. That's the most repeated promise of the Bible. "I am with you." David knew it. 23rd Psalm. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, You're with me." Moses knew it. God said, "Moses, pack your bag, go to Pharaoh. Tell him to let My people go." Moses is like, "I don't want to go there." What did God say? "Don't worry. I'm with you." Joshua knew it. "Joshua, take the people over into the promised land." "I don't think I can do that." "Don't worry, Joshua, the same way I was with Moses, I'll be with you." Peter knew it. "Peter, get out of the boat and get in the water." "Don't worry, that's where I'm at. I'm with you." Paul knew it. "Paul, pack your bags, go to the Roman emperor and tell him who I am and what I've commanded you to do. Don't worry, I'm going to be with you." You see, what happens is we don't see His hand. That's why we've entitled Esther the hidden God. We don't see Him. And so we make the mistake of assuming He's not there, when He is in every single instance and moment of our life. Because like Xerxes, we forget that God ultimately is in charge, and we think that we are. And throughout the book of Esther, over and over and over again, God demonstrates in quiet ways that He is at work behind the scenes to bring about His purposes. And He does that in your life as well, even when you can't see it. He is there. So as we begin our study of Esther, I want to challenge you to get this peace settled in your heart. Because if you don't, you're going to have a world of hurt. Who has the right to rule in your life? Who has the right to rule? It goes all the way back to the garden. And it goes as current as this morning. Who has the right to rule? Have you forgotten who's in charge? Have you foolishly assumed that you are? You're not giving up control to God. If you surrender to Him, you're simply giving up the illusion of control. You don't have control over anything that happens. You just think you do. Have you confused knowledge and information with wisdom? Are you getting bad information bad advice from people? Who do you have in your life to give you counsel? If you're not listening to Him, you're going to end up in all kinds of trouble. Because there's a way that seems right. It looks good. It makes sense. You ever taken some of those paths and found out, man, that was the world's worst decision? Time I thought it was good, but I didn't listen to God. You need to redefine success in your life, men. You've been working towards success at work, working towards success financially, working towards success in any other area that has become more important to you than your wife and your children. If you have, you need to get that right. You know, Xerxes is trying to command respect. I think it's one of the most boneheaded things I've ever seen, making a law that says everybody's going to be respected. He could have made a law that might would have worked. When Memucan said, hey, tell her she's never going to be in your presence again, and sent out this law that says everybody's going to be respected in their home and ruler of their own house, instead, Xerxes could have looked at him and said, you know, it doesn't seem right to me. I think maybe what I'll do is I'll make a new law. Not that one. But I'll make a law that says this. No man in 127 provinces that I rule over is ever going to be allowed to again ask his wife to do something that is disrespectful of who she is. Write that down and send it out to 127 provinces. You know what he might would have got out of that? I would have got some respect. No one can require a woman to be treated like a prize or be put on display. I give him some respect. Might work, Billy. We go that route. And this morning, have you assumed that God isn't present because there's some awful circumstance going on in your life? That God is not at work? That He's forgotten you? That He's too busy? That He's distracted? That He's not paying attention? Don't believe it. He's there. You may not see Him. You may not understand what He's doing. You might not like Him. For you, like for Vashti, like for Esther, like for so many others, He may be the hidden God. But He's there. When the time is right, He will act and do the right thing. Let's pray. Father, I thank You for today, for the opportunity to open Your Word and to begin to study Esther.